Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
The Metaphysical Limits of Artificial General Intelligence by the Lights of Aquinas' Philosophy of Mind. Now, before I will really start the lecture itself, I should point out that this is just somewhat condensed lecture form based on a paper that is about to be published. And the paper is in turn based on an earlier lecture, the conference volume of which will contain the expanded paper itself. I will make the paper available for anybody interested after the lecture, if there will be anyone still interested in the subject, okay? So thank you very much. Let me get started, okay? So one would not expect Aquinas to have much to say about artificial intelligence, AI. But he does have a lot of profound things to say about human intelligence. So we may be well advised to heed what he says about human intelligence against the background of all the contemporary hype about artificial intelligence. This lecture will argue for both an absolute metaphysical demarcation line and a consequent multitude of functional differences between human intelligence, as Aquinas conceives of it, and AGI, the yet future artificial general intelligence. Nevertheless, the paper also points out that in the context of an appropriate social ontology, understanding AGI as a powerful tool of human intelligence, it also provides for us a tremendous opportunity to better understand and even improve intelligence, human intelligence, and thereby human life in general. So what is the scholastic Aristotelian meaning of the term intelligentsia? As is well known, the English word intelligence and its cognates in other modern languages come from the Latin intelligentsia, a nominal derivative of the verb intelligere, meaning the activity or of thinking or understanding. However, as is often the case with such nominalizations, it was used not to refer to the activity itself for which the scholastics coined the word intellectio, or just use the infinitive of the verb intelligere, as was their wont, but rather to the ability or capacity or power to perform the activity, and thus in this usage, it refers to the same as the most used name of the power to think, namely intellectus, that is intellect, disregarding now the usage referring to angels or separate substances as intelligentiae. Okay. So far, so good. Having clarified the meaning of the term, we can ask about the thing designated by the term according to that meaning. What is that power? And I have here the reference to the passage in Aquinas' commentary on the sentences where he provides precisely this intended meaning of the term intelligentsia. Okay. Now, the intellect and its functions. As Aquinas often reminds us, powers come to be known from their activities. So we first need to understand the activities of the intellect, the first systematic analysis of which was provided by Aristotle in his De Anima, Peripsychias. There, Aristotle distinguished three activities or operations, namely simple apprehension, judgment formation, and reasoning. From our current point of view, the most crucial is the first operation, because the other two are derivative, riding on the first, as it were. After all, to form reasonings, we first must form judgments or propositions to serve as the premises and conclusions of our reasonings. But we cannot form judgments unless we first form the terms, whether simple or complex, that can serve as a subject or predicate of these judgments. However, we can form complex terms only once we have formed simple terms, that is, terms that do not contain other terms as their components. So all intellectual operations must start with the formation of simple terms, which in the mind are referred to as simple concepts. This is the process of simple apprehension, or in scholastic terms, indivisibilium intelligentsia. So this is the primary intellectual operation accounting for the possibility of the others. Now, what is this primary concept formation, the simple apprehension, and how does it take place? For Aristotle, this is the primarily distinctive operation of the human intellect, insofar as this is the one that produces the characteristically intellectual cognitive representations of external reality, namely universal representations, which the purely sensory powers of even the most advanced brute animals are incapable of producing. The deep-seated metaphysical reason for this, Aristotle and Aquinas argue, is the immateriality of the human intellect, which brute animals do not and cannot have, for this is the distinctively human power constituting the specific difference of our species, namely rationality, primarily rooted in the rational power of the human intellect on the cognitive side, and free will, the power to choose, on the practical side of a specifically human form of life. So that belongs to us. Okay. In any case, it is this specifically human cognitive function that Aquinas' most intriguing argument for the immateriality of the intellect is based on. Now here is the argument itself, as Aquinas presents it in his commentary on this second book of Peter Lombard's sentences. And I quote, "Aristotle shows that the intellect has an act of being separate from matter, not dependent on the body. And for this reason, it is not said to be an act of the body, and Avicenna calls it a form not submerged in matter, and in the Liber de Causis, it is called a form not brought down on the body. And the middle term for demonstrating this is taken from its operation. For since nothing can operate except a thing that exists per se, it is necessary for a thing that has a separate operation per se also to have a separate act of being." So from separate operation, we move to separate act of being. "But the operation of the intellect belongs to it separately, so that it does not communicate in this operation with a bodily organ. And this is clear for three reasons, and these are three auxiliary arguments supporting the minor premise, indicated very briefly. First, because this operation covers all corporeal forms as its objects, therefore, it is necessary that the principle of this operation be free from all material forms." This is just a quick allusion to Aristotle's argument in the third book of the De Anima from the universality of the scope of intellectual representations, basically arguing that since the intellect is capable of representing all material natures, and what represents a whole range of natures cannot have that nature which would prevent the representation of some of these natures. Therefore, the intellect must be free from material nature, that is, must be immaterial. But that is not the argument I'm going to deal with. It is the second one. Second, because understanding concerns universals, whereas in a corporeal organ, only individuated intentions can be received. Now, this is the argument I'm going to expand on. Third, because the intellect understands itself, but this does not occur in a power whose operation is performed by means of a corporeal organ. This is the self-reflectivity argument that Thérèse Corry did some very interesting work on. But I'm not going to deal with this either. This is the one, it is the second argument that supports the second premise of the main syllogism that I'm going to deal with. But first, here is the main syllogism. Whatever has an operation separate from matter has an act of being separate from matter. The intellect has an operation separate from matter. Therefore, the intellect has an act of being separate from matter. In the first premise, any act separate from matter, whether it is an operation, a secondary act, or an act of being, a primary act, is an act that does not actualize matter, as opposed to acts that do, such as an act of sight or the act of being of the power to see, which are clearly the acts of the eyes, optical nerves, and the optical cortex. But thinking, the claim is not such an activity or actuality of any part of the body. So you're not thinking with your brain. The brain is simply supporting the information for the intellect to work on. Okay. So, the three auxiliary arguments Aquinas is briefly alluding to in the text are meant to prove the minor premise. In this lecture, I'm only going to deal with the second of these arguments, which concerns the universality of the immediate objects of this operation, insofar as this operation targets individualized material natures by means of universal concepts formed from the primary universal representations, the intelligible species, which the agent intellect, intellectus agens, or Aristotle's nous poeticos, abstracts from their individuating conditions. There. Okay. Now, so this diagram sketches out the cognitive process leading from the perception of individualized natures in singulars, and the semantic relations of a common term that would express intersubjectively in communication, in language, these concepts that are formed as a result of this cognitive process. So these gray arrows indicate the cognitive process, and the black arrows pointing downward from the common term are the semantic relations. Material singular beings acting on our senses produce phantasms, the singular representations of singulars in the common sense and sensory memory. So obviously that itself is a rather complicated process. We have these different sensory modalities that our sensory organs are attuned to in the first place. So we obtain visible information of the visible features of things through our optical apparatus, auditory information, etc., etc. We all know that. That needs to be somehow synthesized and put together and store somehow information about the singular individuals that we are getting this information from streaming in through our five external senses, or perhaps even more. We don't need to get into all these details. Well, women are credited to have one more sense, apparently. That's another thing that we need not to get into in this lecture. At any rate, this sensory information is somehow put together, synthesized, and stored in sensory memory in all its singularity. Everything we are sensorily aware of, whether in actual perception or in our sensory memories or even in our sensory imagination, is some singular representation representing something in its singularity. We are going to get into this in a little bit more detail, but that is why this huge database of phantasms stored in sensory memory needs to be further processed intellectually in order to get those universal representations that are the primary universal representations in the intellect, referred to as the intelligible species. These are stored in intellectual memory, in the possible intellect or potential receptive intellect, the nous pathetikos. And these are the ones responsible for the formation of our universal concepts when we are actually needing something like a universal understanding of something. Let's say we are proving the theorem about the sum of the internal angles of any triangle. We need to form actually the concept of triangles universally. Not this triangle here or that triangle there, not even the diagram that we can see on, say, the whiteboard. Those are only the auxiliary sensory reminders that trigger the intellect to form the universal concept whereby we think of triangles universally. Neither isosceles triangles nor scalene triangles, but just triangles. But we cannot draw or imagine a triangle that is neither isosceles nor scalene. And we are not even thinking of a triangle that is neither isosceles nor scalene. But we are thinking of a triangle without thinking that it is isosceles or scalene. Okay? So this is where universality is coming from. But we are going to deal with this issue in greater detail a little bit later. So these phantasms, in turn, serve their information content for the abstractive operation of the intellect to form the first universal representations, the intelligible species, which provide the intelligible content of the universal concepts that apply not only to the singulars they derived from, but to a potential infinity of them of the same kind sharing the same form. That is the important thing about universals. They allow us to have cognition, even of things that we have not ever perceived, and perhaps we cannot even ever perceive. Okay, now we are going on with this, and perhaps I just indicate very briefly that when we are using a common term triggering an understanding, an act of understanding in our individual minds, say when I utter the word triangle, everybody thinks of a triangle. Everybody forms in their own individual minds this mental act that universally represents triangles for all of us, right? That is this common objective content, this common information content that is carried by these individual mental acts that allows us to communicate by using these utterances, such as triangle in English, to indicate or being subordinated to these mental acts whereby we think of the triangles. Okay, now, this is a brief sketch of this rather complicated picture. And let's just see the argument itself finally. So the argument from the universality of concepts, mental representations. In brief, the argument can be stated as the following simple syllogism in Barocco, in case someone is into syllogistic. I just wanted to indicate the particular type of the syllogism. So, all representations that are, I'm sorry, in brief, the argument can be stated as this Barocco syllogism, presupposing in its premises a system of natural encoding resulting from natural causality. It is important to keep this in mind. All representations that are material in their being are singular in their information content. Some intellectual representations are not singular in their information content. Therefore, some intellectual representations are not representations that are material in their being. Now, this is the obviously the first premise is what is crucial. And interestingly, it's not even about universal representations, but singular representations, sensory representations, which are claimed by this premise to be necessarily singular on account of their materiality. But if materiality entails singularity of the representational content, then if we have non-singular representational contents than those universal representational contents must be carried by immaterial carriers. That is the important thing. Okay. Now, if the conclusion is true, then the subject of these representations is not the body or any bodily organ, such as the brain. So the subject, the intellect that processes these representations in the operation of thinking, is immaterial, because it has as its subject the soul alone, even if the soul itself is the form of the body. Thus, the abstractive operation of the intellect producing its primary universal representations, namely the intelligible species, is not the operation of the brain, because it cannot take place in a material medium. So, the intellect itself is immaterial because it carries these immaterial representations, the universal intelligible species, universally representing intelligible species. And if this operation is immaterial, then the power carrying out this operation is also immaterial, which means it is not an act. Its act of being is not an act of any part of the matter or the human body, but it is the form of the human body, the soul itself alone. And this is what gives this particularly specific and unique metaphysical status to the human soul and the human soul alone, namely that it is the form of the body, and yet it has its own operation, which is not an operation of any part of the body, which means this operation can go on even if the soul is not forming, not informing the body any longer, which means the soul is immortal. Okay, this is just a further implication of this conclusion of the immateriality of the intellect, but this is not our main concern now. But rather, the argument itself, especially the proper understanding of the argument itself, which can be obtained by answering possible objections raised to it. Here is one actual objection coming from the nominalist John Buridan. So Buridan might, and actually did, ask, just why couldn't this sort of abstraction be realized in some material medium, say the brain, as a processor of incoming sensory information? After all, even brute animals react to singulars indifferently in a universal manner. A thirsty horse would drink just any bucket of water to quench its thirst. So in its brain, there must be some universal representation of water to drive this universal indifferent appetite, says Buridan. Now, Buridan's objection to Aquinas' proof rests on an unjustifiable conflation between the mere indifference of singular representation obtained by the senses and true universality of representation. The brain operating on phantasms, the singular representations of singulars, whatever their neurophysiological realization is, can render them more and more indifferent by stripping them more and more of more and more explicit or implicit singularizing information, giving them the semblance of universal representations. Yet by the simple process of mere loss of information, they are rendered just more and more non-distinctive, yet not genuinely universal. Take the snapshot of an egg. That picture, despite the fact that it does not carry enough distinctive information to tell from that information content alone which particular egg it is the picture of, still carries information only about that particular egg. So it is not really a universal representation of all eggs, it is a singular representation only of that particular egg. Here is one, for instance. We don't know which this snapshot of an egg we don't know this snapshot on which egg this is the particular snapshot of. But at least in principle, we could trace back all the encodings, transcodings, decodings, etc., that took place from the time when the snapshot of the egg was taken somewhere at some point. And it was precisely that particular egg that got pictured in this picture. So the causal history of the picture itself would provide us with the relevant singularizing information, even if it would be hard to trace. But in principle, it is traceable. Now, on the other hand, whatever this picture represents, it is one particular type of egg shape, right? And in fact, coming from one singular particular egg. The same goes for this zeppelin, even if perhaps it is imaginary. But if we want to get a truly universal representation of egg shape or ellipsoid shape in general, then we would need to go to this mathematical formula, providing us the description of egg shape, covering all possible egg shapes, a potential infinity of them, with all the different ratios of their axes, whatever. Right? Okay. Now, so here is the difference between indifferent singular and truly universal representations. Genuine, naturally produced universal representations, namely the intelligible species, are produced by abstraction, which is not only a process of losing distinctive singularizing information, but at the same time, it is the process of gaining universal information carried individuated by all singular representations of the same kind, so that these universal representations also cover singulars of the same kind we have not yet experienced, of which we have no singular representations at all. What is needed for this sort of genuine, essential abstraction is an agent outside the causal chains of merely manipulating the material carriers of singular information, rendered singular by their own material causal histories, recording the singularizing information about their singular object in their own material features. So when you see two eggs at the same time, you have two eggs in your visual field. You know, you are aware of them in their singularity precisely because they are affecting your visual apparatus causally as being placed in these different places, and the light reflected from the surface of the one hits your retina here, the light reflected from the other hits your retina there. And it is these material differences in our sensory apparatus that are encoding the singularizing information coming from the singulars as such. It is this sort of singularizing information that needs to be abstracted from. But you cannot get this, you cannot get rid of this, as it were, the singularizing information, and get the truly universal content of each if you are just further manipulating the singular carriers, singular material carriers of the singular information. So, what is needed for this sort of genuine essential abstraction is an agent outside the causal chains of merely manipulating the material carriers of singular information, rendered singular by their material causal histories, recording the singularizing information about their singular object in their own material features. Such an agent is outside of these causal chains in the sense that it can grasp that common intelligible content that applies to a potential infinity of entities of the same kind, never represented as such by any of the representations of singulars, but carried by them all. This is why the resulting truly universal representation cannot be material. It cannot have this information content resulting from the further material manipulation of the material carriers of singular information, which are singular precisely because of their material causal histories. Now, let's just grant Aquinas his conclusion, okay, for now. And let's just see what the relevance and what the significance of this immateriality thesis is for contemporary AI systems. Provided Aquinas is right, the implications of this conclusion for AI should be obvious. If the human agent intellect's abstractive operation cannot take place in a material medium, then any AI system, being the material product of the human mind, and thus merely capable of material manipulations of the material carriers of the information it receives, can never produce the simple concepts that the human mind produces in the process of the first operation of the human intellect, namely simple apprehension, although, of course, these products of the human mind can be fed into it using an artificial language encoding our concepts, just as the universal terms of natural languages are artificial material encodings of our universal concepts. So it is not true, in general, that whatever is a material representation, would have to be singular on account of its materiality. It is just true in a natural system of encoding. But in an artificial system of encoding, of course, we can just assign any sort of material sign to a universal concept formed by our mind. That is why we can have so many different languages conventionally assigning different types of utterances or written marks to the same type of concepts that all human beings are capable of forming. Right? Okay. Now, furthermore, the other two operations of the human intellect distinguished by Aristotle, namely judgment formation and reasoning, could quite credibly be mimicked by AI systems using some form of generative syntax and semantical modeling. After all, the generativity of syntax and compositionality of semantics of artificial languages would be just the features of language processing that such systems would thrive on, using their own high-level artificial languages for information processing. Such a system could check the validity of the Barocco syllogism presented above in a fraction of a millisecond, just like a hand calculator would perform a long division that would take us a long time to perform, riddled with occasional mistakes, even with pen and paper. But just because we can entrust this long and tedious process of doing the long division to our calculator, it doesn't mean that the calculator has any idea what those numbers mean, right? And what it takes, actually, to carry out such a calculation. Now, to be sure, today's AI systems, mostly driven by the allure of the so-called infinite monkey theorem, according to which, given an infinite amount of time, even a monkey typing characters at random would eventually type out Shakespeare's works, even if fine-tuned by sophisticated probabilistic algorithms, so it would not take an infinite time to string together intelligible sentences, would not even have a semblance of understanding the argument while they would perform its validity checking, not any more than a calculator has a semblance of understanding its own calculations. But on top of that, even the most advanced, semantically driven AI systems of the future that might use something like the semantic modeling of our concepts, that is a project I'm actually working on, and would still have to use our concepts, which only we are capable of forming for the metaphysical reason provided by Aquinas' argument. So artificial intelligence, being artificial, can only live on and ride on human intelligence. That's pretty much the simple statement here. Thus, if Aquinas is right, even the most advanced AGI, artificial general intelligence systems of the future, will always have to ride on the activity of the human mind, supplying them with its own concepts that these systems would never be able to produce on their own. So again, if Aquinas is right, then there is an absolute metaphysical barrier between human and artificial intelligence. That doesn't mean, though, that there are no features of human intelligence quite credibly mimicked by AI systems, just as there are such features quite credibly mimicked by brute animals as well. And so think about parrots parroting human language. But here is an old Stoic topic for animal intelligence, which is the scenario in which a hound chasing a prey arrives at a crossroads, where it is supposed to perform the following disjunctive syllogism. The prey went either this way or that way, but it didn't go this way, therefore it went that way. Despite its patina, this is the sort of anthropomorphizing of animal behavior that in its careless use can lead to serious misjudgments concerning the cognitive and other abilities of other life forms, whether natural or artificial, where of course one should use caution already in using the phrase artificial life form. Unless we carefully distinguish the proper and analogical uses of such phrases, we can easily, yet unjustifiably, transfer concepts properly applicable to one, but not so applicable to the other. But just as we cannot properly say that the meal on our plate is healthy in the same sense in which we are, unless, God forbid, we are eating something that is still alive and kicking, so we cannot say that the hound is syllogizing in the same sense as we are. As Wittgenstein once wittily remarked, if lions could speak, we would not understand them. And this is one step in the right direction, moving away from unchecked anthropomorphism. In fact, if Aquinas is right, then there is a good reason why animals cannot speak. Their cognition is non-propositional, since they lack the intellective concepts that could then be composed in judgments to perform reasonings for the lack of the immaterial power of intellect performing these functions. So without harping much more on this point, I would just like to point out that if uncritically anthropomorphizing animal behavior obviously leads to fallacious conclusions concerning their cognitive capacities, then so does anthropomorphizing machine behavior, especially when the machine is using language eerily mimicking human linguistic behavior. But there is an even more pernicious implication of the conflation of proper and analogical uses of psychological terms borrowed from the description of human cognitive behavior governed by human intelligence. For although we can certainly apply such terms analogically to describe non-human behavior, as when we say, that's a smart dog, or my car just wouldn't want to start, we should, in our more reflective moments, refrain from thereby either bestializing or mechanizing human intelligence, as in, humans are driven by instinct, or human thought is computation. Alas, many of our contemporaries fall into just this sort of error. And this is the main reason why we should have a clear metaphysical understanding of the nature of human intelligence as essentially distinct from both animal and artificial intelligence, despite their occasionally analogous behavior. But our best guides in this sort of investigation are precisely those Aristotelian scholastic thinkers, especially Aquinas, who in further developing Aristotle's functionalist approach to psychology also paid careful attention to the analogical uses of psychological terms in describing non-human, animal, angelic, or divine intelligences. Now, despite the metaphysical importance of Aquinas' argument when dealing with the broader issues, when we are dealing with the broader issues of human intelligence versus other forms of intelligence, we cannot be focusing solely on the cognitive, intellective, theoretical function of the human mind. For that would mean that we exclude from our consideration the practical side of human life, in which, to be sure, intellectual cognition does and should play a major role. Nevertheless, it is certainly not the only factor in determining our specifically human form of life. This is why the understanding of these other factors as well is crucial in making the relevant comparisons with other forms of life, whether natural or artificial, again, if we can even allow this analogically extended usage of the term life to cover the form of existence of artifacts that exhibit certain intriguing similarities in their functioning to the functioning of genuine living organisms. So to sort out what belongs to what on account of what properly or merely analogically, we need to be clear first on the proper functioning of the human mind or reason as the specific characteristic determining a specifically human form of life. It is only in possession of this understanding that we can appropriately address the comparisons with other similar analogous functions and powers in other subjects. Thus, for instance, just because computers may be equipped with various sensors, that doesn't mean that they will have senses like we do. For human perception is infused with the workings of our inner senses, namely common sense, memory, imagination, and the cogitative power, on the interface between the material senses and the immaterial intellect, as well as their active appetitive counterparts, such as hunger or sexual desire on the part of the senses, and free will, the power to choose, the immaterial appetitus rationalis on the part of the intellect. So we are much more complicated beings, to put it shortly. To be sure, computers will never have the immaterial power of free will, but they will, or even already do, have the ability to imitate our choices, following the patterns of our virtuous or flawed habits. An AI system trained on dirty talk will just talk dirty, disregarding all social norms of decent communication. However, if it is trained to recognize and reject dirty talk, its manners will improve, obviously, analogically speaking. Thus, while we are implementing the training of these patterns, we have a tremendous opportunity. Instead of dumbing ourselves or the perceptions of ourselves down to justify or even unjustifiably extol artificial intelligence, we can use the training process as a magnifying mirror to recognize and correct our own bad habits, thereby perfecting both humanity and its artificial imitations, recognizing in their magnified image the potentially horrific consequences of our own moral flaws. To be sure, all these considerations are presupposing a social context of the workings of human intelligence. Indeed, in closing, let me point to the essentially social character of human intelligence, which is therefore a sine qua non of our form of intelligence, marking out another radical difference between AI and us. And I hope I can finish in time. All right. Until the foregoing remark, my approach has abstracted from another crucially distinctive aspect of human intelligence that we just cannot ignore in this discussion, namely its essentially social character. After all, Aquinas' argument concerns only the natural prelinguistic process of the formation of simple categorematic concepts that would populate Aristotle's system of the categories. However, the formation of these concepts is not what we would usually associate with human creativity, but would rather regard it as a characteristic or indeed a precondition of a necessary stage of children's developmental psychology, and rightly so. Indeed, if Aquinas is right, then his position can give us a clue about why a healthy human baby and a healthy chimpanzee baby raised in the same environment will develop so differently, especially regarding their abilities of language and language learning and use. For on Aquinas' position, a human baby having an immaterial intellect can genuinely produce the immaterial concepts a chimpanzee baby is metaphysically incapable of producing. However, this metaphysical capability of a human child can only properly develop in a social environment, as the developmental problems of feral children, human children grown up in isolation from human society, amply illustrate. I have a number of references to studies about these feral children. In brief, using the words of Aristotle, what these cases show us is that the zoon that a zoon logikon, a rational animal, cannot become a fully functioning human person without being also a zoon politikon, a social animal. And this point brings to the fore the radical difference between human intelligence and AGI concerning the future AGI, concerning the creative uses of language. For the metaphysical ability to form simple concepts from one's personal experiences is vastly enhanced in a social environment by the acquisition of a language and culture encoding and transmitting the experiences and the results of mental operations of countless earlier generations of individual humans. But this process is not just simple transmission. Every user of any language can modify the use of conventionally significant words by subordinating them to their concepts acquired and modified by forming analogies and metaphors in a process of secondary abstraction. This is what underlies creative uses of language, whether in science, philosophy, or theology, using inventive analogies to introduce new concepts by modifying old ones, or in poetry and rhetoric, using metaphors for more powerful expression of our ideas that move both our intellect and imagination. For every word of our languages carries with it a palimpsest of concepts formed by the abstractions of generations of its users, recorded in its etymology. Indeed, just think about how I used in the previous sentence the word palimpsest, which properly refers to a rubbed off and reused manuscript page on which the original writing is still faintly visible. Clearly, in that sentence, I already used the word figuratively, transferring it from words overwriting other words to concepts in their historical development, preserving some of their original content while extending them to characterize new phenomena. Check the etymology of any word we use, and you will find the same. Do you think, however advanced AGI system would get my point? And here I'm linking the etymology of point, the word, would get my point in the way you did without explicitly providing it with the secondary analogical meaning of the term as I just used it. Now, this is a question for further discussion, but if I still have the time for it, let me just summarize everything here in this conclusion. So if Aquinas is indeed right, then his immateriality thesis has far-reaching consequences even for contemporary AI research. Given that any computer we shall ever make will process information in its material medium, the inevitable conclusion is this: if Aquinas' main thesis is right, then all the information any AI machine processes can only be secondarily universal, riding on the universality of our primarily universal human concepts, which can be produced only in the immaterial medium of the human mind. Thus, an AI system will never be creative in the way human intelligence is. An AI system will never form new concepts. It can only reprocess, perhaps much faster and never tiring, but those are other issues, the concepts produced by the genuinely creative because immaterial human intelligence. And that is the happy end of it. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.